title of the talk tonight was, I think, weaponized audio, you called it? Somebody came up with it. Or how to, can you outshout the crowd? This is referring to Husky Stadium. So we have here Ed Simon, who I've known for longer than I've known anybody else in the room. Knew him when I was in college. He runs Simon Sound, and he can tell you all about it. But mostly he builds big PA systems that you can hear a long ways off. Sounds like a reasonable introduction there, Ed?
Sure. So, JJ off. Ed on.
Okay. One, two, yep. Three. Okay. Thanks for coming. Why, I don't know, but thanks anyways. I always like to start off with Barlow's Law. Barlow's Law states that the current in a wire is proportional to the diameter of the wire divided by the square root of its length. And if you think about it, it's completely wrong, because the current should be proportional to the length, because the resistance is proportional to the length, not to the square root of the length. Barlow was the guy who everybody accepted before some high school teacher in Germany named Ohm came up with his version, which he based on measurement. And everybody, of course, disputed that, because Barlow's Law was mathematically a nice exponent and clearly correct, and resistance obviously shouldn't be linear. As a result of Barlow's Law, it was Samuel F.B. Morse who invented the first telegraph system, because he was an artist and he was too stupid to know that you couldn't build a telegraph, because Barlow's Law made it clear that it wouldn't work. In addition to which, he not only had to figure out that resistance was linear, he also had to figure out that when the source resistance matches the load resistance, you get maximum power transfer. And so that's why an outsider invented the telegraph. That's why everybody was wrong, because Barlow wrote Barlow's Law, and everybody knew it had to be right, because mathematically it was a very pretty curve. Okay? And so the question is where do you get a basic education? And these are the books that I think that pretty much so everybody should at least be familiar with. Lord Rayleigh did The Theory of Sound, which was done in an age where he didn't have oscilloscopes, he didn't have any nice chart recorders, and if you ever see the 1934 version of Pygmalion, they actually show you an acoustics laboratory of the time where they've got a long tube resonating with natural gas in it, holes drilled in it, and they light it, and you can see a beautiful sine wave in the flame jets and all the other high-tech equipment of the late 1800s. Verno Knudsen eventually ended up as the president of UCLA. He wrote the book that pretty much so was the first major book on modern acoustics. He wrote that in the mid-30s, where he was using a distortionless amplifier, meaning it had feedback. It was a Black-style amplifier. And his important contribution was not just overall architectural acoustics and writing the book. He also discovered that speech intelligibility maximized once you got above 70 dB, and began to drop when you got louder than 80 dB, because above 80 dB, the ears compressors were beginning to kick in, and that really is a little bit too loud for speech. So when he was designing his auditorium systems, he would design them to reproduce the sound to a level of between 70 and 80 dB in an auditorium. And so with his design methodology, you would find amplifiers as large as 10, maybe even 15 watts being used for an auditorium of several thousand people. Today we do things a little bit differently. A Theory of Sound by A.B. Wood is a book that is virtually unknown, and it's a very good reference book. It has lots of sites. He was a Brit who worked primarily on sonar in World War II, and as a result, most of the Europeans and the Germans have never heard of this book. A lot of the stuff that he puts in it in the later editions have been declassified sort of stuff. And so it really is a very thorough, very effective, hodgepodge of acoustic theory that updates Lord Rayleigh. Leo Baranek, or Baranek, I never pronounce it right, he wrote the acoustics book that virtually everybody today knows and uses. It's kind of cool because you will find them used, offered for $300. It's still in print, so if you want one, you can buy it for about $17 in the newest, latest revised edition, which came out in the past year. But the old book clearly must be worth more because, people are really paying $300 for that. Now, Harry Ferdinand Olsen wrote a whole bunch of books. The primary one is Acoustical Engineering, which up until recently was available as a reprint. They finally sold out all the copies. So it was $25 last year. Now you'll be lucky if you can find one for $125. What?
A couple years ago when I was in London, I found a company over there that was reprinting it, and somebody wants to get a copy from them, new hardback.
Okay, because Jesse Klapholz in Philadelphia is the one who reprinted it. He got a copy from Mark Gander at JBL, which they sent off to India, where they tore the book apart and reprinted it because it was out of copyright. So you'd have to look at the back cover to see if it's one of Jesse's. There is still one error in it, and that is he forgets on directivity index, he does the log, but he forgets to multiply it by 10 because the answer is in decibels. And so it says dB equals the log of whatever. It really should say bells or 10 times. That's the only error I know of in the last revised edition. But when they reprinted it, they left the error in because it's an exact copy. The Radiotron Designer's Handbook was written by an Australian, F. Langford Smith. It was reprinted by RCA. It was the major book of the 1950s. It covers every facet you need to know to build everything up to a vacuum tube amplifier. It contains everything from transformer design, how you get your windings to minimize capacitance, get maximized frequency response. It discusses the sound quality of triodes versus pentodes and all the rest of the stuff that you're bound to hear today if you hang around too many of those funny people. Okay, and then the Benchmark Papers and Acoustics series was basically a large series of books that was put out by various folks who are generally the National Research Council of Canada were the contributors. But if you want to read Sabin's papers, any of the original papers, that's the set you look for. So if you want to do transducer design, the transducer book you usually can find for a couple $100 if you're looking for that one in particular, because that seems to be the one the fewest people bought when it came out and the most people decided they wanted. Okay, so those are what I consider the basic books. I'm pretty sure they're a little bit more accurate than Barlow's Law. Okay. This obviously is Husky Stadium. The speakers, as you may notice, are large and frequent. And this is what I came here to do. And the question is why did I get chosen to do this? Because in the normal construction process, they hire a consultant who designs it, it goes out to bid, and the assumption is that anybody can build it. In this case, they hired a developer who basically, for various reasons, said, okay, you're going to do the sound system. They did get a bid from one other fellow who knew me, so he added 10% to my price because he knows that I'm a cheap SOB, and he was shocked when his buddy didn't get it for him because I was 10% lower than he was. But anyways, so that allowed me to actually design, build, and be responsible for the sound system, because when there's a consultant designing it for the architect, there's no clear chain of responsibility. And so as a result, the consultants basically put the same sound system in every place they go because they know it worked the last time, so there's nothing new. So the question is how come I got it? And the answer to that is because the fellow who gave them the other bid was Ted Leamy, who used to work for JBL and now works for a competitor. When he was at JBL, the Seahawks were having problems with their stadium because it was somewhere between completely dismal and utterly horrible in terms of speech quality. And so I came out and I tuned it up, and these are the post-tuning results. The red numbers are the ones that are merely bad, where the stadium previously had the lowest speech intelligibility score I'd ever seen. Now it actually came up to almost meeting the current fire codes. The current fire codes require that you average 0.70 on what's called the common intelligibility scale, and you're allowed to have 10% of the seats be below 0.60 or go to zero, because they have this theory that when you announce a fire and 90% of the people get up and start running to the exits, the other 10% may follow. If any of you are watching the scenes of the shooting at the LA airport, there was one guy who sat on the bench while everybody else ran by him. So apparently it's not a good assumption. So anyways, I came out, I tuned this up. They decided that they would save the $6 million of buying a new sound system and run with what they had, so I really screwed up on that one. And so that's why they kind of insisted that when the Husky Stadium came up, I would do it. Now, where I differ is I look at speech intelligibility. And in order to measure speech intelligibility, what we start with is a sine wave. And I presume you've all seen sine waves. What we then do is we modulate the sine wave. So where the sine waves will typically be 200, 500, 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, and 8,000 hertz, we'll modulate it with frequencies like 1 hertz, 2 hertz, 5 hertz. And there actually is a standard known as STIPA, which is where you measure the modulated sine wave. And it's scored from 0 to 1, where a 0.5 being the noise level is equal to the signal level. A 1 is the signal level is 15 dB above the noise level, because generally once you have 15 dB of signal-to-noise, speech intelligibility peaks out, and a 0 is 0. As you can see, when you take your modulated sine wave and introduce noise, you lose signal-to-noise ratio. And so it's a fairly simple method because you can actually play all of the sine wave combinations simultaneously, and then you can record it, and DSP can analyze it and tell you what your recovered modulation was in all of the frequency bands, and it comes up with a number. The CIS scale that I mentioned is you take 1 minus the log of the STI. Since STI goes from 0 to 1, the log of it is always a negative number. So when you subtract that from 1, you get a 0 to a 100% score. The idea is that the CIS should be a rating close to A, B, C, D, or 90% or whatever, because it's a simple mathematical function. It doesn't really track accurately, but it's included in the fire code standard as an appendix. So it's not mandatory, but it's generally recognized that you want to be meeting it. And so this was developed by Hoothorst and Steeniken, two Dutch researchers at TNO in the Netherlands. And this method was originally opposed by all the folks who were teaching how to design sound systems because it is the embarrassing thing of pointing out that their methods didn't work. And so they would go and design a sound system by whatever method they wanted to use. They'd go and measure it with this system, and the system would say, nope, didn't do it. When I first started, what we actually did was we just assumed that you are speaking at 3 to 5 syllables per second, and I speak at 5, and I have a recording of Andrew Carnegie from back at the turn of the century, and he would speak in public rooms at a very measured pace. The rooms would be more reverberant, and so you needed to allow for the syllables to decay. And so when you look at this model, you can see that if you have a reverberant room, not only will the first syllable decay a bit by the second one, but by the time you get to the fifth syllable, you're hearing a little bit of the first, the second, the third, and the fourth. It also shows how noise would fill in the gaps between. And so reverberation and noise would hurt. Now if you talk about an echo coming in, that would also fill it in, and echoes can almost be as loud as the original signal. And so that would really destroy speech intelligibility. Now, reverberation, and I assume you've all heard of Sabin, and it turns out there were two Sabins. There was Wallace Clement Sabin, who was a junior faculty member at Harvard who never actually got his PhD in the physics department. And when they built a new lecture hall at Harvard, they modeled it exactly after the old one they liked, and they found out the new one stunk and the old one was great. And so they said to Sabin, being faculty members, you're junior, you figure out what it is because we all had our input and we don't want any of the blame. So Sabin figured out that the old hall had seat cushions, the new one didn't. So he would, over the course of 2 years, at night, when the hall was empty, he would bring over seat cushions with students, he would sound an organ pipe, and he would see how long the time took to decay. And what he learned was that it was an exponent, the more seating cushions, that basically the square root of that, and he came up with what is now called the Sabin equation, which is the reverb time, which is correctly abbreviated T60, though you'll see it as RT60, almost everywhere today, because that's the version that Altec and Don Davis popularized, is 0.161 times the volume divided by the surface area times the average absorption. And, of course, what people do today is they know the absorption of every surface area. They add up that. They get the total number of Sabins, because Sabin is now the unit of measurement of absorption. So that a 1 by 1 unit, if you're metric, it's a meter. If you're English, it's a foot. Open window absorbs 100% of the sound and, therefore, is a value of 1 Sabin. It turns out, of course, that this reverb time equation is not exactly accurate because not all rooms have uniformly distributed absorption, in addition to which there are cases where it just plain doesn't work because there are geometric acoustics. And so when you get into I was in a church a couple weeks ago where the architect, it's an octagon. 5 of the walls are glass. The remaining 3 walls are marble. The ceiling he made at least triangular vaulted, which is covered with some spray absorption. Had they been curved, it would have focused even better on the congregation, but by placing all of the absorption on the ceiling and all of the reflection on the walls, gee, it's a totally useless church. However, the architect built a really swell-looking building. And so what we look at is decay of sound. And this is an actual another church. This one is, when the church was built, the architect covered the ceiling with tectum. Tectum was invented by Sabin. Tectum is poplar wood chips covered with Portland cement, not concrete. The cement mix itself, made up into panels. It's a fuzzy, coarse white material. Typically comes 1 to 2 inches thick, absorbs sound very well. And if you ever rub your hand against it, it is not a modern ceiling tile because it will take the skin off because it's concrete, but with lots of surface area. Now, in this particular church, they had an expert decide that the organ didn't sound right, so they covered over the entire ceiling. They took away all the carpeting. And so they made this into essentially a plaster room with some round, and it was almost basilica shape. A basilica is a cross-shaped church. In this case, the two sides had the nice rounded tops, and so they behaved like a whistle. And that's why, where normally when you have a reverb time, the sound starts off and it decays. And in this case, you can see it doesn't decay. It keeps bouncing around. And this particular frequency, I forget what it was. I think it was about 500 cycles or 2,000 cycles. So you can look up at the top and see the unit impulse response is the little tiny marks. And you can see that basically the first syllable decays a little bit before you get to the second syllable, but you're hearing, you know, to the 25th syllable by the time you're talking, because the sound never goes away because it keeps on resonating. Now, under Sabin, in order to reduce the reverb time, I assume everybody figured it out. Anyways, to reduce the reverb time, Sabin would predict that if I wanted to cut the reverb time in half, I would have to double the absorption. Well, we didn't do that. We put 16 square feet of 4-inch fiberglass on each side where it was the resonators, and that stopped it from resonating. And so now, all of a sudden, we get this curve, which, as you can see, looks like a reverb time curve. You can see the resonances aren't completely gone, but now I actually have my 15 dB signal-to-noise ratio I need to carry speech in that room. And so this is one of those very clear points that most of you who do recordings say there's a difference between frequency response and time response. And so a lot of people tell you, well, frequency is just 1 over time. It's really not for what we're looking at. It's really three-dimensional. Go ahead, JJ. You're shaking your head.
I'm agreeing with you.
Okay.
Oh, I'm agreeing with you.
Anyways.
I'm the one who beats people over the head with cochleograms, so yeah.
The point is that if I feed a resonance, like in a bass reflex speaker, after I've gotten my energy out of the woofer, there's still some ringing in the port because that energy is still resonant. And so there are many loudspeaker designs which are based on making getting flat frequency response at the expense of extending the time at which the sound occurs. And that's something when you're just looking at frequency response, you completely miss.
Okay, you came back.
Yes, but I don't know why it's doing that. Okay. So all of a sudden, we now look at the stadium. We have no reverberation in the stadium. Well, maybe we don't look at the... No, it thinks we've lost it.
No. Steve?
It'll come around.
Give it a second.
Yeah, it'll come around.
Hmm.
Yeah, I should go down to Google and back.
And sign in when we come back. Those who haven't signed in should sign in.
No, I really think it's this nice miniature connector up here. Well, the computer knows that it's having trouble sending it.
So it's giving you the daisy.
Well, no, it's not giving me the daisy. It's just sitting here beeping at me and doing other fun things. Mm. Let's see what this does. Yeah, let's try starting over. Anyways, what I was saying was that... there we go. Yeah, that's what I thought. There we go. So anyways, in a stadium, because you have an infinite volume, Sabin's equation cannot hold, because it's the volume divided by the surface area and the average absorption, and so that your volume is infinite. So it's very clear you don't have a reverberant field according to Sabin. And in fact, you don't have a reverberant field. What you do have are reflections. There's Sabin's equation before I get to it. As you can see, with an infinite volume, in theory, your reverb time would be infinite. But in practice, because you have no boundaries, you have no reverb time. But we do actually have some boundaries. And what they are is the reflecting surfaces of the stadium. And I think I went too far. There we go. Okay. So anyways, as you look at it, you can see that basically the top of the stadium forms a horn. And so the people in the top section are receiving the cross-field echo, having it compressed down. And so since I want to maintain signal-to-noise ratio, The important thing I have to do is make sure that everybody is covered by a loudspeaker in the direct field, and that my cross-field echo is preferably 15 dB down from what they're actually hearing. I also have under-balcony speakers where people are much closer. And so in that case, I have much less cross-field echo. And the other thing I know is that the under-balcony seating is the expensive seats, and so I tend to run that level only 3 to 5 dB lower, because I want the overall stadium to basically be about plus or minus 3 dB everywhere throughout the seating area. And so we actually have to look at cross-field echo, and then the other thing we have to look at is coverage from speakers that are not the direct field, because any other speaker will bounce a little bit off the people and do whatever. Fortunately, in a stadium, I can aim the speakers so that most of the sound hits the people. People are reasonably absorbent, and I get very little cross echo. But it also means that we need to use time alignment on all of the speakers to make sure that no matter where you stand, you can see all of the various speakers that feed into that area, and cover. Now, Don Davis used to teach that you only want your speakers to overlap by 5 degrees or less at the mid-range frequencies. The problem with that is, I don't know, is anybody familiar with Seattle? Apparently there's this thing here called wind, and it tends to blow. And it seems that the sound propagates through the same air that the wind is moving. And so if you only have a 5 degrees overlap, you're going to find out that if your speakers are going across the wind, it moves to the right, or whichever way the wind is blowing. This stadium, being open at both ends to large bodies of water, gets up to 40 miles an hour winds going through it. So as a result, there is significant overlap. And if you're actually in the end zone where the students sit, you will discover that the stereo image, because it's a monaural system but you're fed from both sides, moves completely from one side of the stadium to the other depending upon which way the wind is blowing. However, because there is more than a 5 degrees overlap, you don't lose the sound. If you've just done a 5 degree overlap, you get people complaining, well, sometimes you can hear it and sometimes you can't, because they're not cognizant that as the wind blows, they literally move the sound around. And so far, what we've discussed is how the reverb is affected. This is Don Davis's equation. He liked to have VMA pooches, whatever. And in his case, the volume is on the bottom, so with an infinite volume, he predicts zero reverb. And the other problem is, of course, that he's got all sorts of things in there. The assumption that Don Davis taught was that because it's the inverse square law, if you have a directional speaker and you're twice as directional as somebody else, you can travel the square root of 2 times that, or 40% farther. And then he's got all these other factors in, like how many different sources you have and the rest of that. And the answer is that this algorithm is still embedded in a whole lot of computer programs, and it pretty much so doesn't work. And that's why when speech recognition software came out to actually measure speech recognition, all the folks who were designing by this method just got really upset because it just didn't work. Okay, now everybody else in the world designs by frequency response. And these are the ease plots showing what the sound pressure level would be at a given frequency in the stadium. We can do 108 dB in the stadium if we wanted to. However, the AES standard for loudspeaker life is at full rated power, a loudspeaker should last 2 hours and half of them will fail by 4 hours. So playing 108 dB in the stadium would give you roughly, because you never really play that's your peak level, you'd probably get a 20-hour life out of the loudspeakers. And as you've already seen, the loudspeakers are all mounted in not easy to access spaces because the owners didn't want to pay for catwalk to get there to service them. That was a couple $100,000. So by limiting the system to a maximum sound pressure level of 105 dB, that 20 hours useful life would go up to 200. In practice, they find that they don't want to run it at 105, they're running at 95, which means the loudspeakers should last pretty much so as long as the rest of the stadium. 20 years.
What, did you have a crest factor in there? Is it that?
I'm talking peak level. Generally, you're running 10 to 20 dB below the peak level, so that when they're running at 95, they may indeed hit 105 on occasion.
Okay.
But when I'm talking by 108, that is actually speech, so I really could hit 118 peak.
Okay.
Which is pretty loud.
That's light enough to destroy all the articulation because the critical bands in your ear are blown out.
Well, when they're playing at that level, one of the things is that the crowd will scream until they can no longer hear the announcer. And because they can actually hear the announcer at a level a little bit below the crowd level, the crowd sometimes will go as much as 10 dB above the announcer level. At the first game, they were running it, peaking at 115, and the crowd was screaming as loud as it could for the first half. And they got complaints by the second half because the crowd was hoarse, and they were still running the system at 100, 5, and that was now louder than the crowd. Because in this particular location, the window does not open, so the guy operating the sound system has to use spotters to tell him how loud things are. He doesn't actually have the ability to do that himself. And so where we can look at this and know that we have uniform coverage of the stadium, we can also make measurements to make sure that the times in any given seat all fall within typically a 10-millisecond window. We have designed the loudspeaker so that the speaker placement really means when you have two adjacent speakers, they should fire within 5 microseconds of each other to whatever overlap seating area they have. And the other reason that Don Davis was wrong about his 5 degrees was if you're in the center between two speakers, it takes the same length of time for the sound to hit you. And he's worried about when you have one speaker that is early and the other speaker that is late, if you've got a 15-millisecond difference between the two, they begin to interfere with each other. And at that point, on a well-designed system, when you've got 15 milliseconds of difference, you generally have 6 to 10 dB difference in level, so the farther speaker doesn't really much matter. And so the next thing we're going to look at is the frequency response of the sound system at the Seahawks Stadium, which you can actually see in this room. One of the issues when they first were tuning up the sound system was that the announcers, was the referee's mic, was picking up way too much low-frequency energy, and they had to turn off the speakers on the south side of the stadium. And they didn't have any of this problem at the Seahawks Stadium. And as you can see from the frequency response at the Seahawks Stadium, it basically goes boom at 150 and then rolls off, which was the designer's intent of that stadium. They were very happy saying 150 is as low as we need to go, and that's what we designed. And they also say we go up to 8K, and that's all we get. And here's another seating location at the stadium where you can see basically the level's a little bit lower, but it's the same design philosophy. Well, we're talking about resonances. At the Husky Stadium, on the north side, it is the old bleachers, the old floor. On the south side, they put in new bleachers. The new bleachers are extruded aluminum. As a result, they resonate at about 100 to 125 hertz, depending upon the exact length of them. And that resonance adds about 20 dB more low-frequency energy when you're looking at it with pink noise. And so the south side, even if you set all your speakers the same, will sound completely different than the north side. And in fact, 20 dB of energy hanging around is enough to decrease speech intelligibility. And so the solution is to actually pump up the bass a little bit from flat on the north side and then cut a bit from the south side, so the two don't quite sound the same, but at least you can adjust the overall bowl for a similar sound when you're operating the system. Now, why don't I really care much about frequency response? I assume you've all seen the Fletcher-Munson curves, which is hearing threshold. And if you flip them upside down, they're hearing sensitivity. And that is your frequency response of the ear changes with the volume of the sound. And so if I'm going to play a song that was originally played at 85 dB and play it at 95 dB, the tonality will not be the same. So if you actually want to reproduce, for example, the classic violin sound to sound like a violin, you must reproduce it at the same volume that a listener would have heard it live. If you increase the volume or decrease the volume, you change the timbre, you change the tonality. So there's no real questions about that. And so I'm much less concerned with looking at uniform frequency response in a large system than I am with direct reflected signal ratios and all the rest of the signal-to-noise kind of issues. So I want the system to be at least 15 dB louder than any background noise, which is not possible in a stadium because the crowd can do 110, 120. And so I'm content to leave it to be almost as loud as the crowd, because when the crowd gets above about 102, they've exceeded the OSHA limits, and I don't really want the sound system to regularly be running above the OSHA limits.
134 recently at the Seahawks Stadium.
Yes, I heard that. However, I do have a true standard, not a calibrator, but a standard, and I would love to test those microphones.
Mm. You would like to make your own measurements.
I just like to check the microphones. I'm perfectly happy to see, you know, but I have a piston phone. It's a Brulin Care. I have the barometer that goes with it, so I'm capable of actually measuring and calibrating the microphones. It is possible to reach those numbers through crowd noise, okay, and particularly if they're kicking the seats. I mean, I did the arithmetic when I heard those numbers, and it is possible, but again, I really want to check it because, you know, that's a pretty amazing reading. At that point, people should have been screaming in pain.
I was there. And the stadium's been louder.
Oh, it's been louder.
Yeah, when we played Green Bay, yeah, it was way louder than when they took those measurements. So I don't, you know.
That measurement is done with the meter in peak mode.
I understand, but again, I'd want to calibrate. I'd want to be sure that the meter was in calibration, because When you get to extremely low levels and extremely high levels, you really have to be sure that your meter is not clipping. And so when you're at low levels, it's the noise level. Like my bedroom at home is 23 dB, A-weighted. Okay, it's 25 C-weighted. But, of course, my house has foot-thick brick walls with fiberglass insulation, drywall, and my windows were $2,000 a piece. So I have a very quiet house. And I live where there's no sidewalk and there's no street lights, which helps. Rush hour does get 2 dB noisier. Okay, so I think you all have a good grasp of what loud is. Seahawks fans clearly do not because they haven't hit 140 yet.
No. We got beat by Kansas City.
I heard that. Yeah. And again.
They're way into the nonlinear propagation level there.
Well, yeah. I question the figures myself. But
yeah, but like I say, anytime anybody wants, I'll be glad to check their microphones.
All right.
Piston phone calibrates at 114 dB, so you really can't be absolutely sure that you're reading accurately. Okay. So the point is that when everybody likes to talk about flat frequency response, that's a fictitious animal. And in fact, one of the things that I love is this is a plot of a JBL 15-inch woofer. And as you look at it, you see that it has a 6 dB per octave rise in theory starting from DC. Because common sense tells you if you have a piston moving back and forth and you double the time, you know, double the number of cycles it does per second, you're putting out twice as much energy, you're seeing the 6 dB per octave rise. Everybody designing a hi-fi speaker would look at this and say, oh, it's reasonably flat between 200 and 400. That's probably its best region. Well, why is it stopping having that pistonic rise? Because in theory, a perfectly rigid piston should continue to rise at 6 dB per octave. And the answer is the cone is beginning to break up. The magnet structure is running out of energy to be able to push the cone that fast at that amount of mass. Then we look even higher, and we see a little bump up around 1K. What is that? That's actually where the cone has decoupled. And is actually the dust cap is all that's moving. And so what's happened is as the speaker moves up in frequency, the cone begins to break up a little bit. But also as it moves up in frequency, the pattern begins to narrow because it acts essentially as a sound column or a line array. When we get up to about the 1K to 2K region, all that's moving is the dust cap, and that gives us a very nice peak because it's very directional, and then it rolls off like a rock after that. Well, how do we know the cone is flexing? Because we look at the off-axis response, and we see that it bumps up fairly quickly, and we see that it actually looks much smoother and flatter. And so a lot of people would say this is good energy response. If you put it in a room, it would give you reasonably flat frequency response. And what I'm saying is, no, this loudspeaker begins to distort at 400 hertz, because at 400 hertz is where my voltage input to my output is no longer linear, which is the definition of distortion. And so if I want a high-efficiency sound system, I will run this speaker up to about 200 to 300 hertz, tops. Because at that point, it's still behaving as a piston. If you have a Baxandall-type tone control, you can correct this to flat in that range. If not, you can use DSP to do it. And so you can actually make this loudspeaker flat. Yes, I do have to put more energy into it, but all the energy I put into the speaker is basically coming out as sound. Once I get up into the region where the frequency response looks flat, that's distortion making it flatter. And so as a result, a speaker like this, when you clean it up, everybody doesn't notice that the bass is better, but the mid-range is better because all the distortion products the woofer creates go up into the mid-range. Now, conversely, I don't really much care about tweeter distortion. If I've got a 4 kilohertz fundamental in my tweeter, the second harmonic distortion is at 8 kilohertz, and as most people here probably know, 5 to 10% second harmonic distortion isn't particularly horrible. And by the time you get to third harmonic, it's not there because the air absorbs all the sound. That's why if you look at the frequency response curves, I can go up to about 8K, maybe 10K tops in a stadium. I'm going to get to 10 or 12K in arena, but at that point I have more power going into the tweeters than I do into the woofers. And so I know that if I want to, I can adjust a compression driver to where I can compress for a shorter time than I can rarefact. And that way, because when you rarefact, you have a limit on the air. Once you get a vacuum, you can't do anymore. So I want to spend more time having the diaphragm move away from the phasing plug than towards it. That is indeed deliberately increasing harmonic distortion. But the distortion is at a frequency that doesn't propagate through the air. So I am able to get more power through a high-frequency transducer by deliberately introducing distortion that I know the air will filter out. Okay, now the other thing that comes on, of course, is pattern control, and this is a JBL horn at various frequencies. I just, you know, felt in order to be fair, I needed to show something about pattern control, and I think you all understand that horns are used to control pattern, as are line arrays and I don't think there's any magic there. There have been all sorts of different claims as to which horn works better and how they do this and all that kind of stuff. And about 20 years ago, I gave a talk where I explained what digital signal processing will allow us to do is not to correct the speakers, but to measure them more accurately and make better speakers. And so today what they actually do is they predict what a loudspeaker horn will be. They use their plastic printer to make one overnight. They go and measure it the next day, and then they make the corrections to their patterns, and they make the one, and generally in two tries, they now get a horn that does exactly what they want. There's also things like throat distortions and other things, and those are pretty well understood. So they know when they've got a horn design and they start seeing distortion, they know they need to add some more mass down at the throat and do a few other tricks. This is among the folks who've been around the block. Somebody always invents something new every week. One of my favorites, I'm just going to go on to the next slide anyway, is ElectroVoice makes an adapter to go from a compression driver to a line array. And it basically is five little tubes that come off, and they're rectangular tubes at the output, and they're obviously merging into a circle at the input. Because the path length is different, they put little foam wedges in, so that in the shortest path, they put the shortest foam, they put the longest foam wedge. In the longest path, they put the shortest foam wedge, because the foam wedge basically slowed down the sound, so that they would get a coherent wavefront at the front of the rectangular adapter, even though the path length was different. Well, one of their competitors saw that and assumed that the property of the foam was to reduce ringing in the throat, and so when they put their foam in the throat, they put in equal lengths and claimed that it's a method of reducing distortion in the throat, not understanding that what it really was a path length equalizer. Now, this is a typical speaker cluster. This one has three long throw line arrays. It then has a subwoofer. It then has a down-firing speaker and then three rear-firing speakers, so that this is designed to cover an end zone. It also then covers the folks sitting right by the field level, which are clear to the sunscreen. They aren't obstructed. And then it covers the people sitting up in the nosebleed section with three different speakers. The structure has some diagonal braces on it because this is Seattle, which is considered an earthquake zone. And in designing these structures, they do not count the loudspeakers as having any structural integrity. And so you put the diagonal braces on, assuming that the boxes themselves have no integrity. This has been reviewed by myself, my structural engineer, and then the local seismic engineer to make sure that it will stay in the air. In addition to which, each speaker has an eye bolt in the back, which goes through a quarter-inch wire rope, which also goes around the structure. So in theory, if there's an earthquake and you're sitting in the stands, you don't have to worry about the speakers falling on you, but probably everything else will. Come on, guys, if there's earth, you know, we'll get into it. We built these speaker assemblies in Pittsburgh. We put them on a truck. The truck bounced them all the way to Seattle. And if nothing broke, they're not going to fall apart from the little bit of vibration you'll get from an earthquake, that it is safe to stay in the stadium. However, if there is an earthquake, you can expect to hear an announcement from somebody very nervous telling you to leave.
What kind of dimensions are these boxes?
Figure the width is just under 4 feet. And I've got some other pictures. So, this cluster is like 16 feet long and about 8 feet tall, 9 feet tall. Weighs about 4,000 pounds. The small clusters weigh as little as 600, 800 pounds. On the north side, this is the south side where they're attached to newsteel, which are standard I-beams. On the north side, they did round tubes. And so we bent an omega-shaped bracket, which the guys hanging it managed to snap one of, because it was only quarter-inch thick steel by 2 inches wide. And so they felt that the omega bracket was designed to clamp and hold tight on the bolts. They were trying to get the flange on the omega bracket to touch the speaker flange. They just kept tightening it. Since they were mountain climbers, they were able to take an 18-inch ratchet with about 150 pounds of force on the ratchet times the 13 turns per inch, and they were actually able to get up to somewhere where they could break it. So we replaced all the brackets, which were ones that were 50% thicker and 50% wider, and then we did a spring bend in them so that if they did that, they would actually bend it there rather than have a sharp bend. There's two different industry bending standards. If you read my bio, I said, I learned sheet metal. There's the International Precision Metal Forming Association, who makes the dies we normally use. Most people who do iron work just literally have a bending machine where they just literally put it in essentially a vise and bend it or something mechanically similar. They use a hydraulic ram. So we got a precision die which actually bends it to a known radius so that we can make sure that our bend is exactly where we want to and make sure that it's essentially a calibrated bend. We can then calculate the spring rates and all the rest of that. There's just all sorts of details on what it really takes to hang a speaker above somebody's head. You know, every bolt is put in with Loctite. Every bolt is checked twice. We designed this with AutoCAD so we can go through and make sure the speakers are absolutely as tight as possible and will cover. The downside is we have one speaker we're probably going to have to replace, and that's going to be an absolute firm because you've got to get up there first. Now, this is one of the under-balcony speakers, and some of the under-balcony speakers are standard two-way bookshelf speakers in the commercial version, which means they've got a woofer and a tweeter. They are designed for flat frequency response. When you walk from an area covered by the main speakers, which are not designed for flat frequency response but are equalized to flat, versus one that's designed for flat frequency response, you can tell immediately that it doesn't sound as crisp and clear, and it really is not as good a sounding loudspeaker, because in the flat frequency response, in order to get that, you have distortion products. And, of course, this is the control room, and there's three racks in there. The rack on the right is for the back-of-house system, which for political reasons was put in by somebody local. The middle rack is the patch bay, which after we went through five or six iterations to make sure everything would normal through, they decided they needed more than the 12 patch cords we gave them. We gave them the colored ones. They brought in another 50 or so. And the humor of this is that the mixing board is completely digitally assignable. So actually, you could do almost all the input assignments in the mixing board. The problem then is nobody who runs a regular mixing board could figure out why input 7 showed up on fader 12. And so having patch cords makes it so that normal people can figure out, oh, okay, here's the patch cord going from here to here. I understand that. I do not want to go into the complexity of setting up a digital mixing board. However, every input is equalized differently. I am a big fan of using a vacuum tube preamp on the announcer's mics. We have the announcer's preamps actually use bipolar transistors into a gain stage which feeds a vacuum tube amp. That way, when the announcer talks normally and then he screams into his microphone, I can have something that has enough gain to amplify that before it goes into the compressor. And then after the compressor and after the limiter, it goes into an A to D converter inside the mic preamp. And then the mic preamp feeds the board digitally. The entire sound system runs off a single master clock. It is AES3 48K standard. I see no reason to run 96K when my maximum upper frequency range is 8 kilohertz into the bulb. Besides which, 192K wouldn't give me all the DSP processing I really like to use. So every loudspeaker not only has a time delay, equalization, they have compression and limiting on every single driver. The idea is that we don't want to be able to blow out a driver because you saw how they're mounted, and to change them, I figure, is $5,000 to say hello. And I really have no desire to do that. In addition to which, we want to run into compression before we hit limiting. And then the time delays, of course, or the audio delays, equalize everything. And that's the part I really most care about. That's more important, actually, than the equalization. And then we have to equalize it so that it's reasonably flat, because everybody who operates the board has studio or concert experience, and they know what they want to hear. And for eternity, all people have listened to his frequency response. And every time you get listener complaints, I've yet to have anybody say the stereo imaging is off, or I didn't like that bump at the 150 hertz. Instead, it's I can't understand the announcer. And Fraser, here's Fraser. Fraser's sitting in the back row. Fraser, would you just say 1, 2, 3 so they can understand why you're no problem?
So they can understand what?
Yes, I just wanted to be sure they could understand. Fraser speaks so clearly, it's silly.
Well, you put me on the spot here. One, I'm a little foggy today. Two, I don't know whether to screw it up for you so you have something to demonstrate or not.
And how long have you been announcing?
Well, at Husky Stadium?
Yes.
53 years.
Wow. Thank you. Yeah.
Out, I do not do the game. I do the pregame and the halftime. I do the fun stuff, the shows, the music, the presentations. I don't know, do any of you remember back to Wendell Broyles?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he was, I don't know why I'm telling you, he was a guy, he really didn't have a very good announcing voice, but he was one of the best announcers I've ever heard, and that was a lesson to me. He knew what to tell you, when to tell it to you, when not to tell it to you, and he could just put it in at the right spot. Lou Gellerman was very good, and then now they've got Eric and so on. But it was an interesting triumvirate.
Now, did all of you notice how Fraser changed his syllabic rate to a much lower rate than I speak at? Secondly, he also knew where to pause. He almost did what is called a Shatnerism. Do any of you know what a Shatnerism is? That's the way I'm speaking now. The idea is to always leave you hanging, waiting for the very next syllable. He learned to do this when working in stage plays where he didn't like people walking out. Drives you nuts, but you think something's coming, so you stick around for it. Where Frazier is able to put his pauses in without making them Shatnerisms, and he just speaks that way. You know, to him it's normal. To the rest of us, you just heard somebody who would have been a turn-of-the-century orator. He speaks slowly, he speaks clearly, he speaks in a voice that would work very well in a reverberant room, and he leaves enough time for the sound to decay.
You're making me feel much more important than I actually am.
Put your fingers in your ears then for... Okay. Oh. Okay, so that was my last slide in this show, so we're going to take our break now, and then after the break, I'll show you some more pretty pictures, and you can ask all those questions that, you know, you're falling asleep to ask. I'm sorry, ever waiting to ask.